This evening we're going to be looking at verse 11 of chapter 5. It depends on your particular translation as to how the text was divided up, but I concluded that the first 10 verses constituted a paragraph, and verses 11, 12, and 13, in my thinking, also constitute a paragraph. The issue in verse 11, therefore encourage one another and build up one another just as you're also doing, it seems to me to need the content of verse 12 to really work that into an idea that is workable. Because in verse 12 and 13, he's talking about the attitude of the brethren as a unit, that they appreciate those who diligently labor among them and have charge over them in the Lord and give them instructions so that they can esteem them very highly in love because of their work and so on. Live in peace with one another. The idea of diligently laboring and have charge over you to give you instruction, that to me is the actual content of the encouraging and building up concept of verse 11. So that's where we're going this evening. We're going to look at verse 11, then we'll get into verses 12 and 13. We have to remember that there is a little bit of a difference between the Thessalonians' situation and ours in terms of the address. This was addressed to a working church. This is a Bible study. So when we get into verse 12, those who have charge over you and so on, the application of that doesn't exactly fit our Bible study, and I'm not even sure that it'll really even fit most of the churches that we attend or associate with or whatever, but nonetheless, we'll talk about that perhaps next week some. I want us to think this evening about his therefore, wherefore, whatever version you got. If you'll notice, if you're using the New American Standard, if you'll notice verses 18 of chapter 4 and 11 of chapter 5, they're pretty close to being the same thing. The translators mislead you a little bit on that, but we'll get into that too. As we progress through 1 Thessalonians, we've taken note of just how critical it is for a believer to be solidly confident in the Lord in terms of what the Lord has revealed regarding what he's doing and what he plans to do. In our last study last week, it was my argument that Paul was so intent on establishing the hope that every believer is supposed to be fixed upon as a pre-tribulational rapture. I realize that all the mid, pre-wrath, and post-tribbers are going to think that this is a theological statement, but it's really, in my understanding, pre-tribulational application of chapter 4 is the only way you can get around the ideas of being not appointed to wrath, but appointed to deliverance, because the wrath is clearly the day of the Lord, and the only ones of the group of people who are after, you know, you got the pre-tribbers, that's us, and then you have the mid-trib, the pre-wrath, and the post-trib. And the pre-wrath of you is the most recent and probably the weirdest of the whole bunch. But they at least recognize that you can't put believers under wrath. So what they had to do was they had to make the first three quarters of the tribulation, the 70th week of Daniel, a wrath of the devil period, so that the wrath of God was only expressed in the last quarter of the 70th week. It's really twisted kind of, I mean, you know. But nonetheless, they at least recognized that they would be in deep trouble if they tried to say that believers are going to be subject to the wrath of God, because it says right there in verse 9 that we're not. So that group at least recognized the tension in the text. The tension is resolved completely if you just go back to chapter 4 and see what the deliverance is, and then he's appointed us to deliverance. So, you know, fit. But anyway, the idea of Paul dealing with what we'll just refer to as a pre-tribulational rapture truth is the hope. That's the hope that he's been dealing with all the way through 1 Thessalonians, the coming of the Son from heaven. And particularly, according to the details of chapter 4, to raise the dead in Christ and to catch up the living to be with him forever. That hope is supposed to be something that we're locked in on that we're going to participate in it, and that without regard for how well we respond to the summons of God in regard to walking with Him in whatever aspect of our lives He addresses. And the reason I say that is because there is actually a group of people who say that if you're not walking with the Lord in the light, when the trumpet blows, you're not going, even if you're, part of the family and all that. If you're not actively walking with God in the light, when the trumpet blows, you don't get to go in this time. Well, Paul just shot that dead in verse 10. Because in verse 10, he pointedly said that whether we wake or sleep, we're going to live together with Him. And the wake and sleep terms are chapter 5. They're not the wake and sleep issues of chapter 4. They're different words and they're different content. The reason why Paul did that was not to encourage people to be careless. He's not saying, it's okay if you're not walking with the Lord, you're still going to get to participate in the hope. He's not saying that. What he is saying is, you're going to participate in hope, period. And that's supposed to be nailed down solid based on the fact that your deliverance from wrath and your participation in the salvation hope is because Christ died for you. And that has nothing to do with how well you respond back to Him in love and faith and those kind of things. The idea of Paul's thinking seems to be this. People who are not walking with the Lord, who belong to Him, are not doing it because there's a deficiency in their hope. That's 1 John 3. If you have this hope fixed upon Him, you will purify yourself even as He is pure. So if you're not purifying yourself even as He is pure, obviously there's a problem with your appreciation or interaction with the hope. So what Paul is doing is trying to nail that down so solidly that people can say, yeah, I'm going to go. I believe in Jesus and I'm going to participate in the rapture and I'm going to be delivered from this present evil age at His timing when He comes. And that's the expectation, because it's that that begins to build in the issues of our personal loyalty and love in response to Him and those kind of things. That's really the only way you can approach this thing on the basis of grace. You have to eliminate the human response issues of disobedience or obedience, of faith or unbelief, of love or hate. You have to eliminate those issues in terms of whether you're going to participate or not, because that's Paul's gospel. You're saved by grace, which means God's going to do it. He has done it. He's going to do it. It's not works, which means it's not going to take your works into consideration for these issues. Now, I've said this before, and you all know it. There is a day when we will face the deeds we've done in our bodies, whether good or bad. But that's not going to be a wrath setting. It's going to be an evaluation setting for a position in the kingdom of Christ. But nonetheless, according to Romans 4:16, Paul said, to the end that the promise might be sure, he took the works out of the picture, human works out of the picture. Because that's the only way the promise can be sure. If the promise of God depends on my specific response in certain ways, then the promise is not sure because my response is not guaranteed. But according to promise, again, Romans chapter 4, Abraham learned that the one who makes the promise, the one who is obligated to keep the promise, so all you've got to do to participate in the fulfillment of the promise is believe Him. So this evening, as we go into verse 11, we're going to actually see that Paul recognized that there is a real possibility, even a real live potential, that believers won't be walking with the Lord like they ought to. That's what verse 11 is about. Therefore, encourage one another and build one another up, just as you're doing. In other words, keep tabs on each other. That's the idea. So that's where we're going. But it's interesting to me that if you were to read the King James, do you have the King James on your? Well, in the King James, verse 11 of chapter 5 starts with the word wherefore. And I think on verse 18 of chapter 4, it's therefore. So there's a therefore and a wherefore. In the New American Standard, it's therefore and therefore. And then, in verse 18 of chapter 4, it's comfort one another. And in verse 11, it's encourage one another. And the verb's exactly the same verb. So you got to say, now wait a minute, why did they translate comfort in verse 18 and encourage in verse 11? Well, what I want us to understand is that translators do the best they can do. And that's all you can expect, is the best they can do. I don't have any confidence whatsoever in what they call an inspired translation. The King James is good enough for Paul, it's good enough for me. That kind of mindless, fear-based theology. And the reason I say it's fear-based is because that's what drives the need for an inspired translation. Because there's too much fear that there might be some mistake we make. And God's not interested in that kind of a fear-based theology. But in verse 18 of chapter 4, we're actually in some ways misled when we consider these two verses together. Because the therefore in verse 18 is wherefore in verse 11 of chapter 5. The comfort one another and the encourage one another, exactly the same verb. The question of why they did that, I'm not going to guess at. I'm assuming that they're trying to stay in the context, and the assumption of chapter 4 is that people are going to be emotionally distraught if they lose somebody that they loved, and so they need to be comforted. That might be valid, might not be, but it might be. And in chapter 5, verse 11, maybe comfort's not the right nuance of meaning, but let's just think our way through this. The idea of verse 18 of chapter 4, Paul's point is different there, because he uses the word therefore, and then he uses parakaleo, which is our old friend in this book. Parakaleo is that verb that means to call alongside. And since you can call somebody alongside in several different ways, then you can translate it in several different ways depending on what the issues are. Okay? So if I'm rebelling against God and somebody's going to call me alongside so that I get back up to where God is, rebuke might be the right way to translate it. Exhort might be. But if somebody is wandering away because they've been overcome by some sorrow or something, then comfort would be a good way to get them back on track. So the word can be translated different ways depending on settings. And, of course, that's what I just mentioned, chapter 4 and chapter 5. But the translator's choices do mislead us because we don't see exactly what's going on. Verse 18 of chapter 4 and verse 11 of chapter 5 are almost parallel. Except that with these words in verse 18 is not included in verse 11. You're to encourage or comfort one another and then build one another up just as you're doing. But I want us to think about what's going on in chapter 4, verse 18, because Paul is actually, he uses the word un, which is therefore. It's almost universally used as therefore as translation. And in the Greek language, that connector means, okay, you've got this body of information, therefore this is the way you ought to operate. It's drawing a conclusion. So you almost expect a therefore to be followed with some kind of an exhortation or some kind of encouragement to do something, because you've got this thing and therefore this ought to be the case. That's therefore. But in verse 11, Paul deliberately chooses dio, which is wherefore, and it's far, far, far less used in the New Testament. It's just used, I don't know, 20 or something times. Therefore is used all over the place. But wherefore, you don't run into it a lot. And the question that you have to ask is, why did he use wherefore? What is the difference in English between therefore and wherefore? And it's often been said, you need to, when the Bible says therefore, you need to see what it's there for. Well, the same thing's true of wherefore. You need to see why it's there, what it's there for. So wherefore is there for, but nonetheless. Point is, the word dio is given short shrift by everybody I looked at Robertson's grammar, he just makes this little passing comment about Dio and goes on about his business. Doesn't say anything helpful at all. And that's really unusual for him, because his grammar is just thick. Normally he has a lot to say about everything. And then I looked, it's in other places, and it's just not, they just almost like it's not there, but it is. It's used enough times in the New Testament to say, okay, why would you go to wherefore? What does that mean? Well, I believe that Dio, the word translated therefore in the New American Standard, verse 11, the word wherefore in the King James, is actually very much like therefore, except for this fact. In Matthew's Gospel, he uses the word Dio one time, and the word translated therefore, 55. Okay, so you have these 55 therefores and one wherefore. Paul, in a very similar way, used wherefore, Dio, in 1 Corinthians one time, and he used the word therefore, 20 times. So obviously, the therefore is the word of choice. You draw these conclusions. So what is wherefore about? Well, it's interesting that the only time Matthew used it was in his explanation about how the religious leaders responded to Judas's guilty reaction, where he comes back with the silver and says, I've betrayed innocent blood, and they say, well, that's not our problem, and so he throws the money across the floor, and they gather it up and buy a field to bury people that can't be buried in a regular cemetery, I guess. I didn't really research all that, but it says, wherefore that field was called the field of blood. Wherefore? In other words, for this cause. Not drawing a conclusion, but just saying, this is the explanation, or this is further explanation for something that happened there. So wherefore is put in place when you want to say something that depends on that earlier stuff, but it depends on it in such a way that you're now going to add some new information to it. And that's basically what's going on in verse 11 in chapter 5. Because he says, wherefore, and what he means by that is, okay, we've laid out the times and the seasons issue. We've told you that God hasn't revealed the timing of this, and he's not going to. But the things that he has revealed are these. People are going to be acting according to their nature. If they're of the darkness, this way they're going to act, and if they're of the light, they're going to act a different way. And in that setting, God has set before those who are children of the light and of the day this fantastic hope that they're going to be caught up together with the Lord, delivered from the coming wrath, the day of the Lord, and the sudden destruction that's going to fall. Delivered from that and given the deliverance that is promised in chapter 4, the rapture. Wherefore, given that information, this is the kind of thing that is going to be the logical following thing. And that is this. You need to be encouraging one another. Well, that's our parakaleo word again, and it means you need to be summoning one another alongside. Well, the straightforward implication of the parakaleo issue is that somebody's out here somewhere. They're not alongside. And based on this fantastic hope we have, there is no excuse for that. John would say, because you have this hope upon him, you will purify yourself. He doesn't say you ought to, he says you will. So Paul is saying, okay, I've laid out this fantastic hope that's ours. Now, if you buy into that you're going to be a participant in it regardless of whether you've responded properly, whether you're awake or asleep, not responding properly, you're going to participate in that. Given that reality, we need to be on each other's case if we see situations where that kind of behavior is way out here. That's not acceptable to God or to God's people. You need to come back over here and get squared away. That's the kind of parakaleo, that's the calling alongside, that's the kind of thing that needs to be being done on a regular basis. In fact, the author of Hebrews says one of the reasons for assembling together is so that we can build one another up in the faith by, my mind just went blank, whatever that text is. Is it chapter 10, Hebrews, where he says that you encourage each other because you're meeting together, you build each other up, edify. That's the issue. And because of the fact of the rapture, for this cause, we are to encourage one another. Call one another to the life that Christ wants us to live on a daily basis. Because you're going to participate in this hope. And quite frankly, you really don't want for the rapture to catch you doing things that you know you shouldn't be doing. That's going to be a very embarrassing situation. John even said that in 1 John, because he said we need to abide in him so that we won't be ashamed before him that is coming. Well, if we have this hope upon him, we will purify ourselves. But if our hope is flagging, then we might not be purifying ourselves. And if we're not purifying ourselves, that doesn't mean we're not going to be caught up together. It just means we're going to be ashamed when it happens, because we're going to be ashamed before him at his coming. If he calls us to himself from something that we shouldn't have been doing, that's going to be extremely embarrassing. And that's why Paul makes it a wherefore kind of thing, because he's saying, for this cause, do this. Because of what this statement is, there's only one reality that ought to follow. If you really believe that your life is going to be finally, it's going to come to the issue of being summoned into the presence of Christ by the trumpet and the voice and that kind of thing. Instant fullness of salvation, glorified body, the whole nine yards. If you really believe that, then what manner of lives ought we to be living? And that's Paul's point. We are supposed to be exhorting. We're supposed to be encouraging, comforting, rebuking, whatever needs to be done, so that we're walking in the light. I really think that's why God wants the church to get together on a regular basis. Because by the function of the church, where the Word of God is explained and expressed and all of that, people are encouraged to live the life of faith. So, the exhortation of encouragement and building up, these are rooted in the hope. It is for this cause, because the hope is real. Whether we are awake or asleep, we're going to live together with him. The hope is absolutely established. You can't get around. That's your destiny. On that basis, then, we need to be encouraging one another in whatever way we need to walk in the light. And the point that Paul is making is that the Thessalonians are to use whatever form of confrontation or communication is necessary to stop any perceived wayward behavior in departing from the kind of life that he has already commended them for in chapter 1, verse 3. The work of the faith, the labor of the love, the steadfastness of the hope. When we get involved in things that are not included in those three, then there needs to be some encouragement or rebuke or whatever, and get back in line, because that was their habit. They had become participants in this kind of behavior to the point that they were examples to all the rest of the churches. And it's interesting also that he says encourage one another or exhort one another or whatever, parakaleo one another, and then build up. And here you have another one another, but that's not the same one another. That's each one to one. In other words, you exhort one another as a general thing, but each one to one, or each one upon one, one to one, you build one up, each other up. This is one-on-one kind of stuff. And probably it wouldn't be an error in making this statement. Most personal growth decisions are not made sitting in a congregation listening to a sermon. Most of them come out of personal interaction. A lot of them come out of families of believers and you know, shoulder rubbing through the details of 24/7, where faults and flaws and that kind of thing usually show up and they get confronted or addressed because they're making life hard on others that are in the mix. Well, the church as a whole is going to have some of that, but it's one-on-one that actually causes the person to stop and think, you know, I really need to ask God to strengthen this area because it's creating problems here. I need this to be done. Well, that's the whole idea of building somebody up. That word, build up, is a metaphor. It comes right out of the building scenario where you take a brick and some mortar and you lay it, and then you put another, some more mortar and another brick, and then another and another one, and you are building this thing up. The difference being that they use stones rather than bricks. And in 1 Peter 2:5, Peter actually says that we are living stones being built up together in the holy, to a household, so that he pictures every individual believer as a stone, and each one of them needs to be put in the place in the building in the right place. And he says that that will happen basically on a one-on-one kind of interaction with each other, saying, and that's the way the body works, where the body has multiple gifts. There are many parts to the body, multiple gifts in that body, and some way or another, that multiplicity of gifts will have an impact on everybody, because all of us have our faults, all of us have our flaws, and those need to be addressed by God's Spirit as He dwells in each one of us and has gifted us to do what we do. And so our interaction, conversations, and all those kind of things, our talk about the way things happened today or yesterday or last week or whatever, all of those things work together to build believers up. And that's the whole picture here. I think that 1 Peter 2:5 is probably the most illustrative term of the verb, oikodomeo, where he talks about building someone up, because the idea is one brick at a time, one stone at a time. And the implication of that is that life is very complicated. Nobody's got a handle on it. And in the complexity of our daily living, the situations we run into address us in both our strengths and weaknesses. We run into things that we don't have any problem at all handling, and we run into other things that really, really stretch us. We don't want to even deal with it because I don't know how to handle that or whatever. And life comes at us this way. So the things where we can handle it, we handle it. But in our handling of it, and in our expression of the handling of it, perhaps the discussion of how we handled it, somebody over here would have had a major problem dealing with that issue, and they say, oh, that's how you do that. And they will be built up by the interaction with the other one in an area where they're weak. But by the same token, this person who handled that really well because that's a strength area, he'll run into something, or she will, and won't handle it very well. And this person who just benefited from this will not have any problem at all dealing with it, and they'll deal with it, and this person will say, oh, that's how you do that. So over time, the whole process works to where weaknesses are addressed by strengths from all different directions, and so we build one another up. That's the whole plan. And that gives the strong impression in this text that Paul is actually thinking about the various flaws and faults that every one of the Thessalonians had, and the contribution that each one in the body makes to strengthening those areas of flaw and fault. And what Paul is actually saying is every one of us needs to be on board in terms of the values and beliefs that drive the behavior of chapter 1, verse 3, the work of the faith, the labor of the love, the steadfastness, the hope. But they lie behind the bottom line issue of chapter 5, the hope. The rapture, the exemption from wrath, the participation in life, in the salvation. That's the bottom line. And that's the thing that initiates and motivates the interaction, the building. So I think the real point there is that all of us have our weaknesses, all of us have certain strengths that God has built into us, and we're simply to permit the Lord to use us that way. One another in the sense of exhortation or encouragement or comfort, and one-on-one on in the area of building up where there's weakness or flaw. And so then he winds the verse up with this statement, just as you also are doing. Now that's an interesting statement because I think that that gives us a basis for understanding why verse 3 in chapter 1's there. They are doing this. They're doing the work of the faith. They're doing the labor of the love. They're being steadfast in the hope. And that means that they're walking with God, and therefore they're already doing this. They're already confronting one another and building one another up. It's already happening, and he's just wanting it to happen more. You're already doing it. But the fact that they were already doing it means a couple of things. One, he's not asking them to do something that they haven't already done. He just wants more of it. In other words, not telling them to do something they can't do or don't have any experience with or don't know how to go about this. There will be times when you will run into a situation where you don't know how to handle this and you don't know anybody else that knows how to handle it either, but it's your job to handle it. In those cases, you're just dependent on God, and he hasn't given you any human helpers. But he did that for a reason, so that the next person that runs into it won't have no human helpers. Somebody has handled it. Somebody knows how that works, okay? Ask them, what did you do? This is what we did. Okay, then that's what I'll do. And that's the way it works. A lot of times, you can actually get the help you need by asking somebody because they've already handled it. So, because Paul says, you're already doing this. So it's not something out of the box. But on the other hand, I think that you're already doing this means that they're actually not ignorant of this whole process either. There are some particulars that are perhaps unique, but encouraging each other to be faithful and building one another up, these are things that just automatically happen in the fellowship of the saints. As long as there's no big conflict going on, as long as there are no walls that are already been put up, it's not a lot of hostility, not a lot of that. That's why he says in verse 13, live in peace. Because if everybody's at peace, then you can see this working a lot better than if there's chaos and conflict and all that kind of stuff. So there are some of those kind of things going on, but he wants them to zero in on the fact that these are the things that need to be being done. Based on this fantastic hope, we are to kind of be watching out for each other. If there's a flaw or a fault that we can say, you know, I think this would be a good way to handle that, then that's the way to do it. And on a collective basis, we do it as we interact with the Word, but on an individual basis, we do it out of how the Word has applied to us, and we have some experience in these areas. And that's how the way that the whole Christian life is supposed to function. And I really think that that's what verse 11 is all about. It's about taking this hope and letting it be the motivation for our participation with one another in the life. Now, next week, we'll actually look at some of the specific particulars, because there is a group within the fellowship of the saints. There's always a group that bubbles up to the top. These are typically identified in the scriptures as elders. People who have matured in the faith, and therefore they're capable now of overseeing younger ones. As somebody comes into the faith, they can take them on and involve themselves in their lives to the point where they can build them up and they can become mature too. So I think that's what verse 11's driving at. And as a practical thing, I was talking to somebody just the other day, I don't remember now who or what the setting was, but we were talking about, I remember now. I was asked to serve on an ordination council yesterday. at the time I was asked, I fortunately had an excuse. I was supposed to be in Georgetown. So I said, no, I'm already busy. But if I hadn't had that excuse, I would have probably had to go ahead and say anyway, no, I'm not going to do that, because I'm not going to lay hands on anybody I don't know. I'm not just going to go in and ask a few questions, and if they answer them right, say, yeah, you're ready for the ministry, because that's just not true. I said, there are far too many people who are in the ministry that don't have any business in the ministry because they're not ready yet. And I said, and I speak from experience on that, because I took my first church when I was 23, and I wasn't ready yet. Nobody told me I wasn't ready. They all told me I was ready. I went to Bible college and got it all done, and, you know, hey, you're ready to be a pastor. Well, that didn't last 30 months or about 30 months, and then I was ready to never be a pastor again. In my particular case, God did not bring a mentor along to help me develop the skills of being a pastor teacher. He let me get out of the ministry for a few months and then put me back in. But the better approach is for the Timothy process, where you take younger men and bring them up in the faith and get them ready for the ministry and that kind of thing. And that's typically the best way to do it. Every one of us have our own history, but since most things done in America today are not the best way to do things, I got caught in that whole mix myself. And I'm not sorry in a sense, because I had to learn a lot of stuff that really had to learn. You didn't have anybody to depend on. You just had to learn it. And we found ourselves in many situations where I don't have a clue to what to do, and nobody else is doing this. I can't find anybody that's doing this. Who am I supposed to ask about this? Nobody but the Word of God and the Spirit of God. So just do it. And over the process, you make your mistakes, you learn from them, you go on. But I really think that the biblical method is for the body to be working in a unity of hope that allows us to build each other up in the truth, so that when we do run into something that we haven't faced before and need some help, there's somebody there that can help us.